to get to this giant rock, you turn off the main highway about 14 miles past Banning. You wind up through the hills, come out into a desert valley, and go until you come to Joshua Tree. Joshua Tree is about 18 miles west of 29 Palms. At Joshua Tree, you turn left on what is known as Valley View Street. It's a hard surface road for about 6 blocks, then you dive off into the desert. Occasionally you see signs of realtors, such as Moonlight Acres, where they're attempting to develop land. There's Moonlight Mesa, Moonlight Acres, Moonlight Garden. Everything is moonlight. Rocky Acres is the only true one. Probably call it moonlight because that's the only light fixtures they've got out there. Loose sand and rat holes over a bulldozed washboard road for 16 miles. Pretty soon you come to a little corner, you make a curve to the left, drive over a few more miles of loose sand and rock, come up over a little rise, and all of a sudden, there's giant rock. Now there's a huge rock, the windsock on top of it, and under this rock is where the College of Universal Wisdom meets. When we first got there, there weren't too many people. Fry was holding forth. He was about the only one we saw that had a crowd around him. Was holding forth, giving a little lecture on what he'd done and so forth. There were a couple people around him that kept asking about this mental telegraphy. Fry said that it wasn't mental telegraphy. He said that it was something else. Fry was standing in front of 1946 Nash, who was loaded with bedding and boxes of his books. Out in back of the Nash was a card table set up with his two books, one of them Alan's Alon, his message to the men of Earth by Daniel Fry, and the other one was his other book, something about the White Sands Incident, or whatever the name of it was. His daughter was selling the books, his wife was staying here. Fry was giving this talk. He said that they didn't communicate with you by mental telegraphy. It was they tapped into your nervous system. He explained to these people who were standing around there that nervous impulses or impulses going down the nerves were electrical impulses, and that's the way everything, I mean, when you hear, well, actually you pick up a sound, a vibration in your eardrum, that changes into electrical impulses and sends it to your brain. These people just tap right in behind the eardrum and send these impulses to your brain. He was throwing around such words as communicate by wireless, transformer, galvanic current, modulated conductor, telecommunications, and so forth. He was obviously really snowing these people. He said you can put a radio into your head by putting two conductors around your ear. He said last night at 10:30 that there was a flying saucer going over about twice the size of a full moon, a big glowing object. He said it had been predicted, but only a few people stayed up because most of the people convention had seen so darn many of them that they didn't even bother to lose any sleep seeing a flying saucer. I asked him about the Paul Coates program, and he said this was never intended to be an investigation. He said it was a TV show only. And he said it was just to amuse people. He said he never agreed to be on the show. He said he knew how a lie detector worked, and a lie detector only shows the degree of importance of a question. It doesn't necessarily say whether you're telling a lie or not. He said question only asked so a guilty person knows an important question. That isn't important in here at all. He said that there was no attempt made to interpret this tape, that the tape that was seen on television, the ups and downs on the tape were made by the operator just for effect. He said the script had been written well in advance of the show, and that he knew what it would say, that he would come out guilty. He said he'd written to J. Edgar Hoover and asked him about the lie detector, and J. Edgar wrote back and said the FBI no longer uses it. He said it's only used for establishing a negative answer. See, he also said that the private detective on the program who investigated his background was a fake. He said that the private detective used answers to given in the morning to another lie detector test, and that the answers he had given were purposely wrong, and that the answers came out true even though they were wrong to show the fallacy of the lie detector test. He said he talked to Mr. Foley of the Pasadena Police Department, who said the lie detector was no good. Then he went on to give a explanation about the how they check people's ages, and one guy they couldn't get it till they bet $10, and then a question became important enough, and he was able to, then he did get a reaction when they bet $10 on his age. All this time, his wife kept injecting little ideas into the conversation, but she was getting pretty well sloughed off. She was sort of a crummy-looking gal with stringy hair, dirty, misshapen wool suit on. His daughter was a pretty good-looking chick, long blonde hair, but she looked pretty ratty, too. She got cleaned up. She was pretty good-looking. He said he worked at White Sands for Aerojet. He said the Air Force or the military, White Sands, proving ground, said there was no such person there. But they did have a officer's club card to prove that he was there. He dug out the officer's club card, and it was a bona fide club card. He said the purpose of denying it was the fact that security didn't want to get any publicity to the place. His officer's club card number was 1442. It was issued on the 24th of January, 1950, and it was signed by Charles C. Wigner, W-I-G-N-E-R, 1st Lieutenant from Field Artillery. He said he knew some generals and had been their reception. The question I had is, do all civilians get Officer's Club card at White Sands? I think maybe they do. Fry then produced a photo that he took of a flying saucer hovering over the ground. He said that it was one of the few that he'd ever seen that was really hovering. But it was still offsetting, so the picture was a little blurred. He took it with a real cheap Kodak Brownie camera. He said that, told these people who were listening, this is still what he's saying, that yesterday during a meeting, they saw a cloud off in the distance, and it kept forming and coming back again. And they thought maybe it was a condensation around a flying saucer. And pretty soon a jet came roaring out, went up, circled the cloud a couple times, and came back. And he said, this was in answer to a question about radar. He said that undoubtedly radar down around San Bernardino had picked this up and that the jets had come out to take a look at it. He said, if the Air Force does have any data on flying saucers, why, they'll conceal it. They can't do anything else because it's such a big thing and people aren't ready to know about it yet. Then we went over and started talking. I saw that Truman's bedroom had a crowd gathering. He was standing up by his automobile, which was a pre-war Buick. It was also loaded down with bedding and books. I was standing in the fringe of the crowd taking a few notes, and all of a sudden Truman saw me and thought I was a newspaper man. He stomped his little harangue about flying saucers, looked over at me and said, son, if you're a newspaper man and taking these down for a newspaper, he says, make sure you get them right. And he was very indignant about it, said that he'd been misquoted too many times, that this was a serious subject. He said that he'd been investigating the Air Force on the 25th of February, 1954. The Air Force came into his home. And this was shortly after he'd been on a TV show and had reported, shown a sketch he had there of a flying saucer. He said the Air Force man told him that after he'd been on television, 200 people came to the Air Force and reported that they'd seen this in the air, and before they'd been afraid to report it. And these were all military pilots, military people, airline pilots, and so forth. As I say, he was very indignant about the press. He said that a lot of people thought that Adamski's photo was a light fixture, but he said that it wasn't. He'd seen one. He'd talked to some people who didn't even know Adamski, who described exactly the same thing that they'd seen hovering over Mount Palomar. This substantiated Adamski's whole story. The next thing that happened was the speech. Van Tassel got up and got his PA system working. And before he said even the program got started, he made the announcement. He said, I have a letter here from Captain Edward J. Ruppelt, who used to head flying saucer projects for the Air Force. If he's here today, make himself known. Well, I had written a letter down there, not knowing what I was getting into, but I'm glad I wrote it now, asking that if they were issuing press cards or anything like that, why that I would get one. Then he got up, Van Tassel got up again a few minutes later, so about 11 o'clock in the morning, and called Truman Bethrum up to the microphone to give the first speech of the day. Pretty warm. In fact, it was comfortably warm out in the desert that day. We were sitting in a car. There was a nice breeze blowing. And it was fairly nice. There wasn't much of a crowd. They'd been screwed up a little bit on their things. Last year, the meeting had run for 2 days, and this year they only planned to have it on Saturday, but things got garbled up, and people came out there for 2 days, so they had decided to run their program the second day. Well, there weren't too many people there. I wouldn't estimate over all 1,500 at the most, maybe only 3 or 4 airplanes and quite a few cars. Well, Truman Bethrum got up. First thing he said was something to about his book. He said, everybody always tries to get up here and sell a book, but I'm not going to. He spent about an hour and a half haranguing the government. It was sort of pointless. He said people would do anything for a dollar, and he said that the military was was only an arm of destruction. They were no longer an arm of protection. I think Sarah's got most of this. Rambled along quite aimlessly. And he said, send kids to back to the soil, not to gunfighters. And oh, he went on and on about how people were taking over the government. And he said, if you see anybody in uniform, they're not for us. That's quite an astute statement. Went on and on. And anyway, the whole thing, after he built up this black picture about how we were going to annihilate ourselves and how we were really going at it, like his pitch was that the outer space people are the only answer to this. Then he finally got back to the point. He said the space people told him that they had no wars, and the space people will give us these secrets. They're going to go around and put good thoughts in our minds. And he said the finest young men were in uniform. We were killing them off, and this isn't right. And they said when we make enough effort, the space people will help us. They won't just come down and hand it to us. We have to make an effort ourselves. And this was the big pitch he was building up to. So then when that was over, I did, this is an insert here, I talked to Van Tasselin, told him about tape recording from outer space via light transmissions that they had made the night before, or they played the night before. Then Van Tassel got up, and he said he wasn't interested in spaceships, he was interested in the people. He had the world divided up into world history, or just say ancient history, whatever you want to call it, into densities. The first density that happened, the world was covered with vegetation. That density lasted for, let's see, when is he down here? 312,000 years. Then they had what they call a polar flip. And this polar flip, evidently the world flips over on its axis or something. Anyway, the first polar flip is what made all the coal fields. This vegetation that was growing was all plowed under, and this made the coal fields. Then at the start of the second era, after the first polar flip, flying saucers bought baby dinosaurs and various things like that to the Earth, and they lived for another era, however long it is, 312,000 years. Then everything was going along fine. The dinosaurs were living here, and they all multiplied, and all these various prehistoric animals came out. And the Earth at that time was covered with a great belt or cloud of water vapor. Anyway, this water vapor was at 112 degrees or some damn figure like that. Anyway, hot enough to be vaporized, still vaporized. Well, then they had the second polar flip. And before this polar flip took place, however, the flying saucers came down, and Noah was running one of the flying saucers, and that's where the ark comes from. He picked up a bunch of animals and so forth, put them in a boat. They took off. Then they had the third polar flip. I don't get what all these things are. Anyway, Noah came back and he paused them, and then Adam and Eve came back at the. This was a. Let's see, at the end of the second polar flip brought in the third density. Then Adam came down first. All the men came down first and built things up, and then the women came along. The rib story, Adam's rib story, isn't true. Both Adam and Eve came down on a flying saucer, and he said that these people. Have a regular bus service between planets. They travel all over space. We're descendants of space people. That's why they're so interested in us. We're called humans because hue means destruction, and we're destructive man. The UFO came over. This is something else he told me. I think this was later on. UFO came over a short time back and hovered over the rock. The FBI came out, talked to him, but all they were interested in knowing was whether or not the UFO was armed. Then says, we have degraded ourselves in such, we're in such a mess, no one can get us out, so space people have come to help us. There's a polar flip due shortly, in 312 years. Normally, they weren't coming back until the polar flip, but we're so screwed up and so close to blowing ourselves up with atom bombs that they're about to come back now. The fourth density, after the next polar flip, will be the sort of utopian density. We'll all live by the golden rule. Well, only those who live by the golden rule will get into the fourth density. The flying saucers will come down, pick us all up, or pick up all those people that are eligible, and haul them out and wait for the polar flip. Then he went on to say that the people in the United States are too lax. That they've got to the point now where they keep saying, let the government do it, let the government do it. Well, they aren't going out and voting like they should and everything else, and the government is being taken over by a clique of baddies. And he says, in fact, the top physicists are mad. He said he got this straight from Washington, D.C. He says, you can look into your eyes. He said, you can just see that they're mad. He said that they're controlled by evil. And he said, they're madly making, fiendishly making these atomic bombs. And the only thing they can think of is destruction, 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 that they're going to blow us all off the map. It's the same people, descendants of the same people, who blew up Maldek, which is Maldek is a planet that was in our solar system one time that was blown up. To protect us from these mad creatures, there are 3.5 million flying saucers around the world. Our astronomers know what they are, know what flying saucers are, and the Air Force knows, and top church people know, but the masses are not qualified to know. And the clique now running the United States is a destructive force. These flying saucers can nullify all radioactivity, and if they hadn't done that, we'd already have killed off half the people on our planet from anemia and cancer. Space people are here because of atomic warfare. They would have normally come during the polar flip, but they're here now. He said that he knows that the polar flip's on the way because in 1945 the magnetic pole shifted. Used to be they published aeronautical charts 5 years in advance, and he knew all this because he flew an airplane or had been around them. They used to publish them 5 years in advance, but now they can't because the magnetic poles are moving so fast. He said this is all secret, but he figured it out. Usually it only shifted 1 degree in 650 years, but in the past 6 years it shifted 0.5 degree. So the polar flip has already started. He said it's just, then he gets back onto the people that are building atomic bombs. He said that the Earth is just like a big flying saucer or anything that's floating around through space. I mean, we're not, just because we're the Earth doesn't mean we're too solid. He said if you were up on an airliner and a pilot started throwing hand grenades at the wings, you'd have the guy committed. Well, they actually, in essence, we're doing the same thing. We're shooting our atomic bombs off and blowing up the world. And he said that we're being controlled by the same people who destroyed Maldek, and they're reincarnated. Space people use light. They don't use atomic energy. We're on the wrong track. And they use a light, which is free, I mean, it's easy to get, and they use light energy for everything. But big business is against this because they want to get into the atomic business, and they're digging up uranium ore, they're building refineries and everything else, and it's costing the government a lot of money, and they're making a lot of money off of it. Therefore, they're fighting this business of doing research on light energy. Now, we're going broke building A-bombs, he says. He said, we know about this free energy, but you can't make any money on free energy. Big powers are interested, and they want war, and war has never stabilized things. And he says, our background talent has gone up in the last few, since 1945, it's gone up tremendously, and we're all very much in danger. He said that the College of Universal Wisdom is trying to get away from this and promote a new thing. He said, the flying saucer people are here and walking among us today, trying to help us. When I talked to this kid, Miller, you've got me with his answer, and I asked him why they take them up. Now, Fry got up. He said, it was about 12:15, and Fry got up. And the first thing he said was, I haven't got the faintest idea what I'm going to say. Well, this was probably the most easily proved state of the day, because if you had just listened to him. Douglas MacArthur, he started plugging MacArthur. He says the world needs a leader, and Douglas MacArthur also knows, he knows about what's going to happen. Probably from the flying saucer people, he intimated this, because when he said stay out of war. Fry wrote to him and sent a copy of his book, but he didn't get any answer back from MacArthur. He really didn't expect to, he said, because he realized that MacArthur wouldn't know whether or not he would use that for publicity or not. He said he could take this letter that undoubtedly MacArthur liked the book, and if he wrote a letter saying that he did, why then Fry would probably use that letter, be base enough to use this letter as publicity. And so undoubtedly MacArthur wouldn't answer him. He said, right now, we're putting a ratio of, or 50% of our production is going into weapons, and we don't use weapons unless they have a ratio of 1 to 100. Now, this ratio of 1 to 100 means that for every hour, 1 hour of manpower we put into work on a weapon, it has to destroy 100 man hours of work. beaches begin to drag, and we notice the people begin to get off the chairs and peel off their shirts and lay down and start taking a sun bath. The sequence of operations here was Bethrum, Van Tassel, and Fry. They got made an announcement and said that Damski wasn't there. He was down at Desert Hot Springs taking a mineral bath. So Fry went on and on, rambled on, didn't say a heck of a lot, just harangued around a while and drifted aimlessly from point to point for about an hour. Then they called this Miller up on the stand. Miller got up, gave his little speech. Then they had this Williamson up on the stand. It was sort of a dead, Sunday was a dead day. Saturday was a much better day. According to newspapers, they had more people and they had a bigger program. A few asides here. This girl, this lady, Dana Howard, happened to park her car right next to us, and we were overhearing everything. She set up her little table outside. In her book, she mentioned something about the fact that the reason she gave up her lover and came back to Earth was to spread the good word. Well, we were sitting there, and all of a sudden she said to a lady that was with her, her little girl that was with her, she said, I'm afraid they're going to call me up there to speak again today. And she said, I'm not going to do it. She says, let's pack up and get out of here in a hurry. So they did. The day before, I had a long chat with Frank Scully. It was rather interesting. I watched him taking pictures of him for a while and took a couple of shots myself. And then when everybody was gone, I went up to him, shook hands with him, and told him I'd been on a TV show with him. Well, he remembered me right away. So he talked all the time. And he didn't say a hell of a lot, except the one thing he said was that these were good people. And he said he got an enjoyment out of them or something to that effect. I never did get exactly what he was driving at. But anyway, he admitted he didn't, he indicated that he didn't believe all this hockey, but they were just good people. The one thing I jumped him about was this business of the two people being indicted by the grand jury. He said that he just wrote the story the way he heard it, and that he wasn't checking into their business connections or something like that. Anyway, he gave me his address. That was about all. There was a Damski was there. The whole crew was there Saturday. And we did get to talk to him for a while. Adamski has been in a flying saucer now. He hasn't ridden in one, but he has been in a flying saucer. The biggest thing of the evening, or the day, of course, was this Miller kid story. After it was all over, he didn't too talk, and I went over and introduced myself, and he was very eager to talk. So he asked me to come in the restaurant, which consisted of almost absolutely nothing. I think there were two tables in there and a long bench. And we got a cup of coffee, and he sat down and started to tell me his story. The thing happened 40 miles out of Detroit, near Ann Arbor, in an old abandoned golf course. Miller's story, in the first place, Miller is from Detroit, fairly young kid, said he'd been in the Air Force. Brown eyes, big brown eyes, wearing a baseball cap, real innocent look on his face, very fluent talker. I mean, he had a way of presenting it in this innocent air that was very good. He's not a ham radio operator, but he had a lot of friends who were. He was messing around with them. They were checking some mobile equipment one night, and they got a very unusual signal on 11-meter band. It was so unusual and so powerful that it overloaded the receiver, and it had an unusual tone. And all of a sudden, the tone stopped, and a voice started. And the voice could have been some ham. A person had a tenor voice and used very good English and was very clear. And they said that they identified themselves as being on board a flying saucer. They said they were here on a friendly mission and had knowledge of our group, and it was in quotes. And he didn't know whether this meant their group of radio operators or the whole world. And they also said and told him to continue to watch an 11-meter band. They did, and he couldn't. All the hams monitored it. They kept up a 24-hour watch. And after September 54, when they got the first radio message, they got 12 to 13 more contacts. The next to last contact, there was a great deal of confusion to the validity. He knew FCC was monitoring it because they saw two FCC trucks. And they said the second to last message, Miller was alone when he got this. And it said to go to Ann Arbor to an old abandoned golf course, and they gave him the location. They said that the message said that personal contact was imperative. And he was alone when it came through, but this one came through in a 16-meter band. So he went out to this isolated place, drove out, went to a gully. Now, it was October 24th, 1944, on a Sunday, at 1 p.m. Well, at 1 p.m., he received the message to be there at 2 a.m. It also said to leave a note for his friends, and they were to be at the same point at, 2 was supposed to be at 2 p.m. And he also left a message for his friends and said that they were supposed to be at the same point at 2 a.m. And they would be contacted by radio. So he left a note. He got there in about 15 minutes. And out of the corner of his eye, saw a UFO coming straight down, very fast. And it hovered on top of the hill. It flipped over once, a little bit on its side, so he got a view of the outside, which he showed me. He saw the profile. It was about 150 feet in diameter, about 50 feet away. Hovered 12 feet off the ground. He went up the hill, and when he went up, he could feel his sort of tingle, his hair sticking straight up, and just like when you get a light shot. But his watch was okay, it kept running. All of a sudden, the flying saucer came to rest just a little bit above the earth, about 12 feet off the ground, and a panel, it was sort of dovetailed, slid open, and a ramp came down. It was just like an airline ramp, and it ended up about a foot off the ground. He was very anxious, to get on, he said. He wasn't afraid at all. In fact, he was very anxious to go because the tone of the messages sounded like these were really good people. The first messages, all of them were witnessed. The only one that wasn't witnessed was the one that told him to come aboard the flying saucer. He looked up, and the interior was all lighted. He saw a chap standing there. He kept using the word chap all the time. Chap standing there in flying coveralls on the top of the step, backing him up. He got off. He walked up the stairway and stepped off into a metal corridor that ran around the circumference of the flying saucer. All of a sudden, the guy didn't do anything at all. He just stood there, and the ramp very quietly and not too slowly just folded up like a filing drawer going into a file, and the doors went shut. And the man motioned for him to following up the passageway. Another door opened, slid open, and he walked into the central control room. It was about 90 feet in diameter, circular, all types of equipment. Now, at this time, my Miller stopped and drew me a sketch of this and explained it to me. He went over to shake hands. The man came up, stepped up to shake hands. Miller put his hand out to shake. Or the man stepped up as if he was going to shake hands. Miller put his hands out, and the guy just moved right by and put his hand on his shoulder. And then he said, in perfect English, he says, "Please don't feel foolish." And those were the first words he'd spoken. Miller assumed that this was some kind of a greeting, that they didn't shake hands, they put their hands on each other's shoulders. He looked around, there's no one at the controls. The windows in the thing were about 20 to 25 feet off the ground. And then he told about the people. They had different colored coveralls on. The guy that he met had white coveralls on, that meant he was captain of the ship and a philosopher. And the color denoted the occupation and the grade. Orange was an astrophysicist, and purple was an electronics man. All the controls that he saw were push buttons and signal lights. There were no rheostats, meters, or anything like that. The suit's clothes were one button suit. That cloth was a metallic sheen. He wore ankle-length cloth boots. The guy he saw looked like Clark Gable, he said, about 45 years old, very distinguished looking, black hair that was graying at the temples. His name was Soltec, S-O-L-T-E-C, S-O-L hyphen T-E-C was his name. He told why he was interested in us. He said that directly ahead of us in space was a cosmic cloud. There was a concentration of cosmic rays. When the Earth passes, it affects our magnetic lines of flux and causes earthquakes, floods, and so forth. And Soltec told him there were 3.5 million flying saucers around the planet, and they were putting up a force field that was screening us from this horrible mess of cosmic rays. He said that they had been doing this for a year, and that the cosmic ray count and background count has been increasing. This is a pitch that other people use too. 1957, we'd be in the heart of the cloud. They had a technology to put up their own barrier, but we didn't, and therefore they were protecting us. They couldn't help us too much. I mean, they could help us a lot, but they couldn't completely nullify this cosmic cloud. Therefore, we would have some effects over the period of the next 70 years. We'd all change. Then Van Tassel stuck his nose into the conversation and told about how he'd contacted the people. This flying saucer had hovered down over Giant Rock Interplanetary Airport, and these three men had been in the ship. The one that spoke to him was named Solganda, S-O-L-G-O-N-D-A. Had a little chit-chat between themselves about how poetic these names sounded. This cosmic cloud, and then they started back, this cosmic cloud we're going through affects the human brain. We can't stand it. We're going to have heart attacks, mutations, and so forth. And they couldn't stop this. They were interested in this because, one, we were nuts for building A-bombs. Number two, they were forced to, they'd been forced to nullify two atomic shots. One in the USSR, one of them was in the USSR, he wouldn't allow it to explode. They'll never allow us to explode a true H-bomb. These, so far, we've exploded, they say, claim we've exploded, have been imitation H-bombs. And they'll never let us explode a pure H-bomb. The reason that they stopped these two shots, one in Russia and one in the USSR, in the U.S., was because they were boarding on being true hydrogen bombs. There's an asteroid belt that once was a planet that blew up, and the planet we call it Moldek, but the real name for it is Lucifer. And we would he told us, Moldek, or whatever his name was, told, not Moldek, but Caltech, or whatever his name was, told him that, this Miller, that we would, we'd make a satellite, that we would go to the moon, but then we'd never get any farther because we don't have the technology to do so. They have something similar to the United Nations called Universal Federation. There's 680 planets, all the same solar systems and galaxies. It's very similar to the UN, as they say, and they've had it for 20,000 years. They're not allowed to go into and invade anybody, but if anybody's going to destroy themselves or something like that, or be destroyed by some outside force, why, they can come in and help. That's why they're here. There were five men on this spaceship that Miller talked to. Each one was from a different planet. One was from Mars, one from Neptune, one from Uranus, and he didn't know where the other, forgotten where the other one was from. They were all specialists. Oh, he said that, he repeated this stuff about the United Federation had a law they couldn't interfere. The only thing they could do is if some outside force or blow-up was coming in, are going to take place. He said when he was in his spaceship, he didn't feel that he was moving. There was no inertia, but he did know that he was moving. He said they had vision screens, so they knew where they were going. He pointed this out to me in a drawing, and he said that one time he knew he was riding around space because they turned on his vision screen for him, and he saw a planet in full color. He didn't recognize the planet, but he did see clouds, land, and sea. He told him a lot of planets, and I forget, 22 of them, I think, were inhabited. Well, then about 15 minutes before the time for the contact, Miller asked this Soltech if he could talk to his buddies on the radio. And Soltech said, well, he didn't know. But he had a thought, he evidently had a thought conference with his other crew members because he didn't say anything, but pretty soon he said, well, come over here. So 15 minutes before 2 a.m., when they turned on the radio, they wanted to contact the group. He went over to the instrument board and looked at, pulled out a one of the new instruments that had just been installed, and told Miller that this was a 50,000 watt transmitter the size of a pack of cigarettes, and it was a plug-in unit, just plugged into the board. He couldn't see any unit because it was sort of, he could hazily see through it and see a bunch of stuff in there, but it was opaque and he couldn't see any. At 2 p.m. he went over to the desk and sat down and looked for a mic, couldn't find him, and Soltech said, you don't need a mic, just talk. So he started to talk, and he called his buddies, and then they flipped on a vision screen for him, and he saw six of them sitting in the car. And it was quite a thing because it was all in color, and this thing went right through the roof of the car, and he could see them sitting there. And he got quite a laugh out of the fact that he told his buddies they were on TV, and he was reading them six, and getting them very, very clear. And Moldek talked to him, too. Then there was another one. Then after he got through communicating with these people, Mektaw, M-E-C-K-T-A-U, Mektaw, was the electronics man. He got a hold of Miller and explained to him that they want him to set up a light beam system. And they want to use a light beam because they would keep things confidential that way, and they wouldn't be on the broadcasting on the air. And also keep FCC, so FCC keep their nose out of the thing. So he told Miller about the type of equipment. We want to use the infrared, use this infrared beam and so forth. Well, at about 2:20 or 2:30, well, all of a sudden they turned on a vision screen and saw that he was on the ground. He walked to the hatch and got back off at the same place. By this time his buddies had gone, and of course he went running right back and talked to them, but they'd parked only 100 feet away from this hill, and the flying saucer wasn't there, so evidently he knew he'd been out and been gone from the spot that he had actually been for a ride. Of course, the people in the car left just the minute that the transmission was over, because they were tired and they wanted to go to bed, but they did see the spaceship go overhead. So he made they made this IR light beam thing, and they contacted the flying saucers. They knew that they were transmitting because there was a luminous ring around the transmitter, and it pulsated along with the transmissions. So they were modulating their, modulating their force field. This Rick Williams, Williamson was there. They parked in the beam of the IR stuff, and Williamson saw this, and they modulating their force field. And then one time, there were always people there, you always had witnesses to this thing. At one time, they saw 12 UFOs and groups of three fly over. All this happened in Detroit. He said that he came out here about Christmas time, or Williamson somehow got in touch with him, and Williamson went out there and brought him back out to California about Christmas time. He told Van Tassel and Fry, and he also confirmed that Fry was there, because this Soltec told him that they had picked up a man once before and carried him to New York. Let's see, there was something else that he brought out here. Oh, yeah. He said these six people didn't want to name them now because he hadn't talked to them about it, and he'd come out here not expecting to tell this story to anybody, that he and Williamson were going to do some red-hot research on it, but that now that this thing had broke, why, if it ever became necessary, he could dig up the names of these six people that saw it. I didn't push him any further because I couldn't check on it if he did give me six names, I wouldn't know who they were. But that's about the size of the whole thing as far as his story was concerned. They say he was very convincing. After he gave his speech on Saturday, which was he was the ace in the hole, the keynote speaker, his was the punch. Why, he had people all around him wanting to take his picture, and he was signing autographs like mad and various things like that. He was a real nice guy, very, very nice. Well, I guess that's about all. I think that just about takes care of everything.